Sanders wins Washington State. Now what? Welcome to KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Bernie Sanders scored big over Hillary Clinton in Saturday's Democratic caucuses. Sanders could net more than 60 delegates from our state. Sanders supporters are so passionate. Would they accept Clinton as the nominee if they had to? KUOW's law and politics reporter Amy Radel has the story.
Bernie Sanders was expected to make a strong showing in Washington state. The day before the caucuses, thousands of his supporters lined up at Seattle's Safeco Field to hear him speak. One was 18-year-old Riley Dolan, who was signed up to help run the caucuses at his college, Pacific Lutheran University.
Yeah, there was a lot of students feeling the burn at PLU.
Dolan says he learned about Sanders' campaign through the website Reddit and likes the senator's talk of building a revolution. But Dolan says he's prepared to go beyond just supporting Sanders.
It's not just the president. It's not just about Bernie. It's about electing Congress for people that we feel we want to make change.
On Saturday morning, Jamie Bliss is one of the first-time caucus-goers streaming into a Seattle elementary school to support Sanders. Bliss is 38 and works as a community mental health counselor. She says her college loans have been a big struggle to pay off, so Sanders' push for free tuition resonates.
Our country is supposed to have all these opportunities, and look at how debilitating it is for a young person to go to college and try to afford that. So I'm one of the products of that.
About 60 people from Bliss's precinct are gathered around a table in the school gym. Initially, Sanders has twice as many supporters as Hillary Clinton, but four people are undecided. The debate ensues. Clinton supporter Nancy Elder tries to win people over.
She can actually get things done by compromise. Bernie's pretty contentious. When you look at their voting records in Congress, they're about 98% of the time the same. But who's been more effective? Who heard of Bernie before last year?
Now, Bliss is one of the handful of people to speak. She says she appreciates Sanders' relentlessness, his focus to push beyond incremental change.
Whereas he will say, yes, we will make this change, but it's still not good enough. And that's why I want to vote for him.
On the second tally, the undecideds go for Sanders. One of those is Jake Fawcett. Fawcett is 41. He says in the 90s he supported candidates like Ralph Nader and refused to vote for Bill Clinton. But this year, Fawcett says he'll be open-minded.
The general election is not the place to have your most pure ideology reflected. That's where you're going to try to choose the best strategic choice in that moment. So, yeah, definitely I'll be voting for Hillary if she's the nominee, and hopefully getting out the vote in my neighborhood.
As she leaves the caucus, Jamie Bliss says only a scheduling conflict prevented her from becoming a Sanders delegate. She felt like her involvement had a tangible impact at this caucus.
Out of any other process we have in our election system, this weighs more to me.
Hillary Clinton is leading Sanders in the national delegate count, so a strong showing in Washington is a key part of Sanders' strategy to move forward. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
In that story, you heard that caucus goer, Jamie Bliss, say how much caucusing matters to her. Caucuses are lively, for sure. You can see people get together and commune, maybe argue for their candidates, vote for delegates. Is caucusing, though, the best way to choose a presidential candidate? Erica C. Barnett says no. She reports at the CisForCrank.com. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Bill.
Why do you think the caucus system is a bad system?
Well, I think it is fundamentally undemocratic, I say that because so few people participate. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but one is that people are busy. And when you're talking about committing, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, some unknown number of hours in a lot of the Seattle caucuses, you know, I mean, people who have to work can't do that. People with kids have told me, you know, I had to leave because I was there for 3 hours and that was all my kid would take. So it may feel good to be able to participate in the argument with your neighbors, but ultimately it excludes a lot of people who can't make it. And it's, you know, and as you can see from the actual turnout, it's incredibly low. It's like 6%. I mean, if it ends up breaking the 2008 record, it's going to be 6% of registered voters in Washington state. And that's just not representative of anything.
Also with us, Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. Hi, Eli.
Hi, Bill.
Caucuses, as Erica said, low turnout equals undemocratic. What do you say?
Well, there are a lot of problems with accessibility for caucusing, but I don't think that means the answer is to do away with caucusing. I think it means we should make caucusing better and more accessible to people. I don't agree with the idea that caucusing is undemocratic or anti-democratic, as Erica put it. It is one of the oldest forms of democratic expression we've got in this country when you just boil it down to people getting in a room and hashing out arguments and having a civic dialogue and listening to each other and changing minds. That's the core of our democratic fabric. And the more that we can encourage that, especially at a time when so many people are retreating to life behind screens, to kind of an atomized existence where they don't engage politically with their neighbors and don't get involved in political processes and end up mistrusting institutions and processes partially as a result, the more that we can pull people out of, you know, their little enclaves and out from behind screens and into the public square for interesting civil debate and for mind-changing experiences, that the better. And so I don't think we should do away with caucuses. I think we should make them more accessible. We should really promote a lot more than we already do in the Democratic Party anyway, the surrogate voting ability. And then better than that, we should have voting holidays. So Election Day in this country, the November Election Day, should be a federal holiday so that people all across the country, whether you're voting by mail or in person, have the time to vote. And in this,
okay, let's break this down a little bit, Eli, because you know a lot and have a lot of opinions. I just want to make sure we've discussed this central question, Erica. It's not undemocratic. It's activist democracy. What do you say? And please, frame your answer in a civil, constructive way.
I mean, Eli made a whole bunch of points in that spiel, and I want to respond to a couple of them. One is this idea that, you know, that this is the oldest form of democracy, and therefore we should preserve it. When caucuses were begun, it's true, we didn't have screens. And the thing about screens and what you're calling screens, the internet, is that we actually have a lot more ways to participate with each other right now that, you know, that are a lot more inclusive than, you know, than this get together with your neighbors, spend a Saturday hashing it out in person. I think that the reason I would call that anti-democratic is, again, because no matter how open you make it, no matter how many notices you send out or, you know, whatever you do, fundamentally, in-person communication is both going to be more difficult than communicating online, and it's outdated. And, you know, you personally, like right now, I am communicating with, you know, I don't know how many people are being communicated to by I don't know how many people about Bernie and about Hillary online. And frankly, you know, a lot of that has been extremely unproductive. A lot of that communication is unproductive. And I didn't caucus this year. I didn't feel the need to go and get yelled at by my neighbors. And I also feel like it's kind of, you know, when you call it an activist thing, it is. It's exclusionary to the people who, you know, want to sit around and hash things out and make their points. And like I said before, it might feel good. It might feel like democracy when you go. But ultimately, you're just standing around having a college debate session. People's minds don't generally get changed. And, you know, in the example that just played now, or a moment ago, you know, three or four people's minds got changed. I think it would be a lot more inclusive to do a primary where people can get the information they need online, not from their neighbors, and vote that way.
Okay,
and
let's let Eli respond,
too. Would increase.
Well, so these ideas are not mutually exclusive. You can get information online, and you can have information and debate online, and you can also then go and have a human interaction, a face-to-face public civil discussion with your neighbors. Those aren't mutually exclusive ideas. But there is a contradiction at the core of what Erica was just saying. She didn't go to her caucus because of the tone of the vitriol online regarding Hillary and Bernie, so it scared her away from her caucus. So how does that make sense? She doesn't like the tone of online debate,
that's
but she also doesn't like
okay,
the caucus because...
You guys can speak to each
why?
Other.
And
yeah.
Actually, a lot of people at my caucus were surprised by the civil tone of the debate there as opposed to the debate online.
Yeah, Eli's saying nobody was yelling.
The reason I didn't go to the caucus is, and maybe I was unclear, the vitriol online is plenty for me. I have been to caucuses twice in the past, and the main reason I didn't go this year is I was, like, frankly scarred by going the last time in 2008 because, you know, in addition to people yelling at me online all day, it was just people screaming at me about, because I supported Hillary in 2008 and there was an overwhelming, you know, amount of support for Obama in Seattle, and particularly where I caucused in Capitol Hill. And it was intimidating, and I'm not easily intimidated, but I found it intimidating to have people yelling at me in person and saying, you know, frankly, really offensive things about Hillary. And I, you know, I didn't feel the need to put myself through that. And from what I understand from people who have talked to me about their experiences this time around, surrogates tended to be more likely to be for Hillary, and people who showed up in person were more likely to be for Bernie. Now, I don't know if that, like, statistically holds true over the whole city, but I know a lot of people who signed surrogate forms. That's what I did because, you know, A, I had to work, and B, I don't like getting yelled at by people, and that's been my personal experience.
Okay, listen, Eli Sanders and Erica C. Barnett, we've done a good job laying out some of the pros and cons, some of the objections. Eli, what about just the bottom line of turnout? If turnout is low, let's set aside whether people are yelling or whether people are busy. If turnout is low, does that equal less democratic a process?
Well, sure. More people involved in the democratic process is always better, and that's why I think the answer is lowering barriers to caucus participation, but not doing away with them completely, not doing away with caucuses completely. And just to say, I mean, both Eric and I are just speaking from our own experience, but at my caucus, there were a number of people who said, I enjoyed this a lot more than the angry debate that's going online. This was surprisingly civil and engaging, and a lot of people ended up getting even more engaged than they were in the political process when the caucus started by becoming delegates. We heard from your report before this segment started about someone just like that who showed up at the caucus and ended up a delegate. And that's great. That's a net gain for participation in the democratic process.
Okay, so is there something we can agree on for a solution given caucuses? I hear both of you agreeing on some imperfections. Eli said, your voting holiday. Erica, what's the world you want to see for Washington State, just talking about Democrats now?
Sure. I mean, I have to say, I love the idea of a voting holiday. I do think we should do that. But I think that, you know, there's no ideal solution, but I do think primaries, which the vast majority of states have adopted, and real primaries, not like the beauty contest that we have here in Washington State after the caucuses, but real primaries, increase participation in the same way that, you know, the same reason that we have vote by mail here in Washington State. If you lower the barriers, you increase participation. And I don't think lowering the barriers to caucusing is going to increase participation, you know, as much as having a primary would, because it still requires you to take time off during your Saturday, which, you know, if you're a Starbucks barista who works on Saturdays, good luck with that. And go to a place and sit around for an indefinite amount of time. And that's a huge barrier for a lot of people.
Erica got the first word. Eli Sanders, final word. What's the world you want to see? What are you advocating for the most?
Well, it wouldn't have to be on a Saturday. First of all, if we had voting holidays, it could be on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and everyone would be off work, so everyone would have time to participate in a caucus. And I agree with Erica, the more participation, the better, the more people involved, the more democratic something is. But I just disagree. I think we can lower barriers to caucus participation. And, you know, I've never seen anyone become a delegate to their county convention just by voting on a mail-in primary ballot, or have a really interesting mind-changing discussion with their neighbors just by sitting at the kitchen table and marking, you know, a bubble on their primary ballot. There are real tangible benefits to caucusing that draw people into the public square, into civil discourse, which Eric and I both agree is lacking often, the civil discourse aspect of it, online. So the more we can promote that in public and promote participation in democracy, to me, the better. And I think caucuses have a huge potential to do that.
How are we going to conduct our democracy here in Washington State going forward? Eli Sanders, Associate Editor for The Stranger, Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Is it primaries? Is it caucuses plus a voting holiday? Some combination? Another idea? here's where we're having the conversation, fresh off the Bernie Sanders win in Washington State over the weekend. So what do you think? We are live tweeting this show at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. We'd like to hear your take on what happened over the weekend and the best way to conduct our democracy here in this state as we continue to select a president. This is KUOW's The Record. So that was a discussion about how to do it, how to caucus or primary, et cetera. Let's talk about what happened and what happens next in the Democratic delegate process between Sanders and Clinton. Washington voter David Reyes spent the last week deciding between those two. Do I support Bernie? Do I go for Hillary? He even went to public appearances by both candidates. And then on Saturday, he went to his precinct caucus at a South Seattle elementary school, and he caucused for Sanders.
The more progressive value that Bernie is advocating for is the direction. And if anything, it sort of puts, I think, our party on notice that we have to be really much more broad thinking about what we need to accomplish in this election.
Bernie Sanders' win here will put the Democratic Party on notice. Is that true? What's the Sanders victory going to mean for the future of Democrats? I put that question to political science professor Megan Ming Francis at the University of Washington. She started by telling me how Sanders' message is attractive here because he talks about so many issues many Washington residents already care about.
There's a lot of appeal for somebody who focuses on issues in terms of the environment, that's anti-big banks, and that very much is concerned about economic inequality in a way that I think Clinton is not.
What makes you think Clinton is uninterested, relatively uninterested in income inequality?
I don't think she's uninterested. I think that she has a different approach. And I think the biggest concern, and you know, this is something, of course, that Bernie kind of sounds the alarm about all the time, is her kind of coziness to big banks, which especially in the aftermath of the recession of 2008, has a lot of people feeling uneasy.
Why did Bernie Sanders do so well here compared to most other states, especially in the South?
Well, I think one of the big differences here, I mean, of course, is going to be the kind of issues of racial demographics, right? And so Bernie Sanders doesn't do as well with African-American voters who make up a large part of the Democrat population.
Why does he not do well with African-Americans?
Well, I think a number of reasons. The way that I think he thinks that we can address really serious issues of racial inequality is by addressing kind of the economic issues, right? I mean, all social scientists will tell you that these issues are always intertwined. The concern, I think, for a lot of African-American voters and Latinos and Native Americans is that in some ways, while economics are intertwined with issues of racial inequality, you can't fully address issues of racial injustice through an economic plan. And so I think that's why not a lot, but a number of African-American voters are unsure right now about Bernie Sanders.
Who's going to be the Democratic nominee?
This is a tough question. I love this question, though. Months ago, I would not have even thought that we would be here talking about Bernie Sanders right now winning Washington. But I think it's tough. But she needs over 1,000 more delegates right now. There's three other big days coming up. One, April 19th, which is New York. That's over 290 delegate votes. And then we have April 26th, which is going to be kind of the East Coast. And so a number of states that I think Bernie's message would resonate are going to be voting. And then, of course, much later on, you have California with over 500 delegate votes in play. So right now, even though the establishment thinks and says that, like, Bernie's out, I watch, you know, the news, the return, people are always like, Bernie's out. I think he's still very much in. And I think this kind of the Northwest will be a wake-up call to the Clinton campaign.
If Sanders doesn't win the nomination, but he carries on to the convention, what could that mean for the future of the Democratic Party?
It depends how Clinton's camp plays it. A lot of Democrat voters are persuaded by the message of Bernie Sanders. If I'm a strategist over in that camp, I'm like, this, what we need to do is we need to meet with Bernie Sanders and some of his top aides, and we need to figure out how we can change our message and our platform to incorporate and include some of his positions, in particular around economic inequality and how to address that.
Megan Ming Francis is a political science professor here at the University of Washington. Does Bernie Sanders have a realistic shot at the nomination, and how could that happen? We're going to dig into that this afternoon in the 3 o'clock hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. This next story is about how we can solve old crimes and prevent new attacks and how much we're willing to spend doing that. It begins with a story, and I want you to know that this is a story that might not be appropriate for young listeners. 30 years ago, a 13-year-old girl named Jennifer Bastian went for a bicycle ride through Point Defiance Park in Tacoma. Several weeks later, her body was finally found in the park. Jennifer had been raped and murdered. Detectives have DNA evidence from Jennifer Bastian's killer. But 30 years later, they still don't know who that is. Jennifer's mother, Patty, thinks there is a way to find this person. She wants police to go into Washington State's backlog of untested DNA evidence from rape cases. Nearly 6,000 unsolved cases, test all of that DNA evidence, enter it into a federal database, and try to find a match with the DNA from her daughter's killer.
The case rests squarely on the shoulders of DNA evidence. And unless and until there is another piece of DNA that matches this DNA in the national database, I don't know that any amount of work will ever find the suspect unless that person confesses.
How much do you still think about finding a suspect?
It's not, you know, I want to find him and beat him to death or anything. That's not it at all. I just want this person to be off of the street so that I know in my heart there is not going to be another little girl that and another family that will face what we have faced.
Why do you think that your daughter's murder could be solved if we analyze more DNA evidence collected at crime scenes?
Because I don't think this fellow woke up one morning and said, I'm going to go to Point Defiance Park and snag a little girl off of her bike and kill her. I don't think he just woke up that day. And it looks like people like that have patterns. And so there were probably people who were molested or raped or battered or something before this. And in some of those instances, perhaps his DNA was taken. But it hasn't been either put into a database yet or something.
Tacoma Police Detective Lindsay Wade works on cold cases like Jennifer Bastian's. She's hopeful about a new Washington state law creating a tracking system for DNA evidence from rape cases. This evidence is commonly called a rape kit. Detective Wade told me that Patty Bastian's theory is right. Testing older rape kits and putting DNA evidence into that federal database called CODIS could lead to Jennifer Bastian's killer.
We know that evidence from rape kits can oftentimes yield a DNA profile. And sometimes that DNA profile, when it's put into the national DNA database, will actually give you a name of the suspect. Sometimes that DNA profile won't necessarily match a person, but it can be linked to another crime, which could give us a great investigative lead. So we know that the offender in Jennifer's case is not in the national database already. We know that. But that doesn't mean that there's not a rape kit sitting on a shelf somewhere containing that our same offender's DNA. And that case may have a known suspect. It may have a description of the suspect. There may be something in that investigation that could provide us with a good lead and help us try to determine what the identity of that person is.
You've spent a lot of time and energy working particularly on Patty Bastian's case, the case of Jennifer Bastian. What is it about Jennifer's case in particular that has motivated you?
Because I grew up in Tacoma, I heard about the case when I was a kid. I was a couple years younger than Jennifer, but it stuck with me. It's one of those cases that I never forgot about. And so it's to me, it's one of the most horrific cases that I have investigated. And it bothers me that it's unsolved. And it bothers me that I feel like the offender's right under our nose. We have his DNA profile, but we don't know his name. And so I feel like the answer is out there and I just have to keep digging. You know, I think the biggest issue for me is making sure that convicted offenders are in CODIS. And we have offenders in our state who have been convicted of violent felonies who are not in the CODIS database. And so that's, to me, that's a problem.
Patty, you're nodding your head. I wonder what's going through your mind as you hear about this idea that this person could be right under our nose.
Somewhere along the line, he left his DNA. And more importantly, it probably is existing in this state. Now, he could very well be in jail or prison. Wouldn't that be nice to know that he's already off the street? But having all that evidence and not being able to put it where it can be useful, that's a waste to me.
It would cost millions of dollars to analyze every DNA sample on police shelves. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Washington State struggles to pay for education, healthcare, right, et cetera. Why is this project more important than lawmakers have realized up to now?
Because I think that we can provide answers. We can provide long-awaited answers to survivors of sexual assault with the testing of these kits. And from my perspective as a cold case detective, we can potentially solve some cold case homicides with the evidence that could be contained within these rape kits. We do know, you know, that a lot of times sexual offenders are serial offenders. And, you know, typically they don't just have one victim. They have multiple victims. You know, some of these offenders are pretty smart. They go from place to place. They travel from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, understanding that if you commit a crime in a different location, you're less likely to be caught. So DNA and the DNA database can connect cases across the country, which is an outstanding thing for law enforcement.
Patty, what do you say to someone, a listener, a lawmaker, who says, great idea, but we've got pressing needs now. We don't have the money to spend analyzing every one of these evidence kits on the shelf.
Until it happens to someone in your family. Your daughter, your wife, your niece. The value isn't in the money spent as money is spent. The value is assuring the public safety by one person at a time that can get caught, be tried, and put away.
Patty Bastian lives in Tacoma. The rape and murder of her daughter, Jennifer, 30 years ago, has never been solved. Lindsay Wade is a cold case detective with the Tacoma Police Department. Washington State is poised to become the first state in America to create a statewide tracking system for rape kits. Survivors will be able to track this evidence from the hospital to the laboratory to the police station, and advocates hope this tracking system could lead to more testing of old rape kits. Currently, 6,000 in Washington State remain untested. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. Two local tech companies, Expedia and Amazon, have recently gone public with gender pay gaps within their ranks. Why did they do this? Well, in part, pressure from Arjuna Capital. The company describes itself as an activist investment firm, which means the firm buys shares in companies they want to see use more socially and environmentally conscious methods, and then the company brings those methods up for a vote at company shareholder meetings. Arjuna's director of equity research and shareholder engagement, Natasha Lamb, told Jeannie Yandel that Arjuna Capital started looking at tech companies last year and found what she calls a woman problem.
In that there aren't many. They only make up 25% of the workforce, they occupy 11% of executive positions, and only hold 10% of board seats. What we know is that across the United States, women are paid 78 cents on the dollar for what men make. And in technology, women are paid $10,000 less on average. As investors, we know that gender diverse teams, particularly leadership teams, lead to more innovative outcomes, which is key for the technology industry, and that gender diverse teams also lead to better performance at the company. So really, our question was, you know, how can we encourage a shift at these companies so that more women are incented to stay in tech roles and move into leadership positions so that these companies are as successful as they can be and performing well and innovating and treating their workers fairly.
You decided to at least start this process by giving a proposal to shareholders of tech companies, asking that those companies disclose their salaries. So at least there's some transparency about any gender pay gaps there. And in one case, there was some kind of quick action. Expedia said, yes, we'll disclose pay information and we'll come up with a plan to deal with any pay gaps by the end of the year. Amazon did not have the same response, and they kind of pushed back on you, actually. What happened with Amazon?
I was surprised to see Amazon take a defensive approach because it is such a core business issue. But they went to the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, and they challenged the proposal. They tried to get it knocked off of the ballot, and the SEC said, no, this is an important issue. And after the SEC ruled against Amazon, the company changed its tune, and they came out and they revealed what their gender pay gap is, and they committed to keeping it closed now into the future.
So Arjuna Capital essentially got what it asked for, which means that you were able to withdraw the shareholder proposal to discuss this in the first place. How will you keep pressure on companies like Amazon, for example, to keep them accountable when it comes to a gender pay gap?
So what we're starting to see now is that the technology industry is setting a new standard of committing to equal pay for equal work. And corporations can't sit pat on this issue. You know, it won't be till 2058 that the gender pay gap closes if we continue on with business as usual. So we do need bold leadership today. And, you know, we'll keep asking these questions because they're important questions, they're important for the businesses, they're important for society. And I think one thing we'll see is that a lot more investors will start engaging many more companies on this issue.
Natasha Lamb is Director of Equity Research and Shareholder Engagement for Arjuna Capital. It is an activist investment firm that has pushed Amazon, Expedia, and other tech companies to narrow the pay gap for women. She spoke there with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. Here's a news update in case you haven't heard about this. A U.S. Capitol police officer has reportedly been shot at the Capitol Visitor Center complex in Washington, D.C. The shooter's been taken into custody. The White House was briefly put on lockdown, but that got lifted pretty quickly. The police officer who was shot is not believed to be seriously injured. Visitors were being turned away from the Capitol as emergency vehicles just flooded the streets there and the plaza nearby on the east side of that building. We're going to keep reporting on this and give you an update in about 15 minutes here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. The presidential candidates are tapping into voters' frustration about a lack of good-paying jobs. Well, that might be about to get worse. And the Seattle area is part of the trend. Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Welcome, John.
Hi, Bill.
The job killer we're talking about this time is technology. What kind of technology are we talking about?
What we're talking about is a new wave of very advanced information technology, robots, automation, and artificial intelligence. And this is not like your daddy's robots or anything that we've seen before, and it's coming down the pike, and none of the candidates are talking about it. It has the potential to eliminate millions and millions of jobs.
Can you give one example you're thinking of this this robot, this technology?
Well, right now, if you go into a Boeing plant, you'll see humans and robots working side by side. And, for instance, painting a wing can be done in just a small amount of time by robots compared to by humans. So That's an instance right now where you see robots and humans working together, but necessarily some jobs were eliminated. But where we're headed is what you see in Foxconn. We're in China.
What is Foxconn?
Well, Foxconn is the huge manufacturer that builds your iPhone and all sorts of electronic devices. And they employ hundreds of thousands of Chinese workers. But they are putting in hundreds of thousands of robots. Their ambition is to have dark plants. In other words, plants that don't have any lights on, because everything is being done by robots.
Okay, so there's robots and all the way up to advanced information technology, artificial intelligence. So we want to know today, John, how do we think this is going to affect the jobs that we humans do?
In 2013, two Oxford scholars did a study on this and went pretty far in depth and said that it could affect 47% of the occupations that we have now. And the problem that we see in this recovery and in the recovery before that, and even going back into the early 90s, is that we have these jobless recoveries that are very slow to take off. And in the past two, we still haven't replaced all the jobs that were lost in the Great Recession. And the ones we have replaced have generally paid less.
So you say that technology will affect 47% of jobs, but affect how? I mean, yes, any jobs are changing. They're going to be different. We might be working with robots, like at a Boeing plant, but will those jobs be replaced? Didn't they say that about the Industrial Revolution, too?
I'm not sure they said that. I think that the Luddites, who got a bad rap, who were these high craftsmen, saw that the machines were going to take away their work.
Yeah.
And it would be a more shoddy product, but it would be cheaper. But in the Industrial Revolution, just like with the automobiles and the so-called buggy whip manufacturers, the automobile industry created millions more jobs than it took away. This time is different. We already are seeing how automation has hollowed out the middle jobs that used to be done. The clerks in a newsroom that used to take phone messages, well, that's all automated now. And this is only going to get worse, and we don't have any kind of policy prescription, such as a universal income, as a real universal health care system, that could make this into a great thing for human beings.
What do we make of the example of Amazon, which is well known for using robots, but it also employs a whole bunch of humans?
Amazon's employment has roughly doubled between 2014 and 2015. And so you could look at it a couple of ways. One is that you could look at it as a hopeful sign of how automation and humans can work together. But on the other hand, when you look at the entire spectrum of companies, Amazon is an outlier.
So generally, you're convinced that the trend is toward humans having less and less to do.
Sure. I mean, Eastman Kodak employed tens of thousands of people, and Instagram employed a handful.
Well, you could paint this scenario in different hues, right? So worst case, massive unemployment and misery, et cetera. Or maybe machines are so productive that we're all better off, then it's a matter of distributing those gains. So how do you look at the future?
Well, exactly. I mean, if you want to look at a relative optimist, you can look at Pedro Domingos at the University of Washington. He's studying this intensely. And even though he is an optimist, he concedes that we're in for a very rough ride in the coming decades, and that people will have to vote for basically a new kind of economic system that redistributes wealth downward and not just upward. And this is not something that Americans will, at least 40 or 50% of Americans, can easily get their arms around.
Bernie Sanders supporters are jamming the phone lines right now, saying, we get it. Redistribute downward.
Well, I hope they get it. You got to have a Congress to do it. You can't just have Grandpa Simpson in the White House. Obama was a transformative leader, but he didn't have the Congress.
So besides any future income redistribution, what else can we do? I'm thinking about education, but you tell me, what should we be doing right now about this coming automated future?
Well, people need to be effectively retrained to work with automation and AI and these other advanced things, but there is a limitation to how much you can retrain, especially if you're talking about a 50-something auto worker who's just out of a job. This person would rather have his leg cut off than go through quote-unquote retraining. We could undertake a massive, massive forward-leaning infrastructure program, say building high-speed rail. This would create a lot of construction jobs and a lot of operating jobs that simply can't be done by robots. But beyond that, in the decades ahead, we're probably going to have to create something like a guaranteed universal income, guaranteed universal health insurance, or you're going to have a real revolution and not the one Bernie's talking about.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton with one view of the future. Always good to talk with you, John. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
KUOW is The Record.